This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
For this month's Job Bite, I'm interviewing Dr. Ian Harrison, who quite recently joined the Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics as a postdoctoral researcher. So welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Can you just tell us a little bit about what you're working on?
What I have been working on since I came and joined you is mostly the superclass experiment, which Manchester is leading, very heavily involved in. And what that is an experiment to try and measure a weak gravitational lensing signal in the radio galaxies that we see in the universe. There are a lot of weak gravitational lensing experiments which have previously been done using optical galaxies that we can see in the universe, and it's a very good way of constraining theories of dark energy and dark matter and how the universe has evolved. But we're also interested in looking at the same effect on radio galaxies rather than simply optical ones.
So can you give us an idea of what weak lensing involves?
Weak lensing is primarily a way to learn about the distribution of dark matter within the universe. And dark matter, very obviously in the name, we can't see it, we can't see its interaction with light directly, but what we can see is the bending effect that it has on light. So if you have a big lump of dark matter in front of some luminous galaxy behind it, then the lump of dark matter will have this lensing effect on the light of the galaxy behind it and bend it in kind of arc shapes around the clump of dark matter. And that's a very good way for us to learn about how much dark matter there is in the universe and where it is, because it enables us to measure directly where the dark matter is rather than having to make some assumptions about the relationship between where dark matter and where luminous matter is in the universe. Using this weak lensing technique, we can see very directly where the dark matter is due to, as I say, the effect it has on the light coming from the background galaxies.
And that bending, it's not doing that because it's dark matter as opposed to any other sort of matter, it's just that there's more of the dark matter than anything else.
Yes, right? So any matter which feels the force of gravity will have this lensing effect on light coming from behind it. It just so happens that we expect there to be significantly more dark matter in the universe, and so the vast majority of the lensing effect comes from the dark matter, yeah.
And if we imagine a galaxy sort of sitting in a big halo of dark matter, does that mean that the lensing effect you're looking for is caused by the galaxy's halo, or is it just caused by other dark matter that's somewhere in between us and that galaxy?
That's kind of something that you have to deal with. So you can see where a galaxy will be, the halo around it will be a very concentrated patch of dark matter. And that can cause these very strong gravitational lensing events where you see these very spectacular banana shapes, essentially the background galaxies get lensed into. But all of the other places in the universe where there aren't these halos around galaxies, we expect you can go away and look at pictures from the Millennium Simulation as a very good illustration. We expect there to be this kind of cosmic web of filaments and halos with voids in between. And all of that dark matter will be creating this lensing. And one of the things that you have to worry about when you do gravitational lensing is that we only see the total effect of all the lensing between where the galaxy emitted its light and where we see it here. You're looking in one direction, so you see the effect of all of the dark matter along that direction, whether it's very concentrated or whether it's more diffuse.
And all that stuff together is what causes what we're calling the weak lensing.
So all light in the universe will have been lensed to some extent, and the distinction between strong lensing and weak lensing tends to be that a strong lensing event will create more than one image of one background object. If you show someone a picture of gravitational lensing, you tend to show them a strong lensing event because it's very obvious. In weak lensing, we're not looking so much for the distortions of an individual object. We're looking for the average distortions over a whole population of objects. Because although the distortion on a single object might be incredibly small, and also we don't necessarily know about what the shape of the galaxy was to begin with, if we see over some patch of the sky that all of the galaxies in that patch of sky tend more than average to have a certain amount of distortion, then that enables us to say something about the dark matter between us and those galaxies.
So you're looking for a distortion of shape?
Yes, the change in the amount of ellipticity of the galaxy is what we look for. So that's kind of the smallest effect before you get the bending effect into these banana shapes. You just get a change in the ellipticity of the galaxy.
Okay. And we interviewed Joe Zuntz a couple of months ago about the Dark Energy Survey, which was looking at weak gravitational lensing using optical telescopes.
Yes.
And what you're doing is like a counterpart to that, it sounds like. In what ways can you put those data together?
Optical weak lensing has been the mainstream way of doing weak lensing for the past few years. It's only recently that we started being able to do it, even in the optical. And the reason that it's taken place in the optical is because we can simply see enough of those background galaxies in the optical in order to be able to measure the shapes of enough of them in order to be able to get a good signal for our weak lensing. The reason it hasn't been done with radio galaxies before is that there simply haven't been big enough radio telescopes to get the necessary number of background sources to be able to see this small but coherent distortion in the shapes of the galaxies. But I'm sure people have probably spoken on the Judcast before about the SKA, the Square Kilometre Array, which is an incredibly huge radio telescope which is going to be built in the coming decade. And that will allow us to do weak lensing with radio galaxies because it will be able to see enough of them. And the project that I'm working on is using the eMerlin telescope within the UK, which, whilst it probably won't see enough galaxies, do a large enough survey to tell us anything particularly new about cosmology, it will enable us to develop the kind of techniques which we're going to need to use for the radio weak lensing surveys, which will happen with the SKA and will do interesting cosmology. So we're kind of breaking fairly new ground for weak lensing in doing it in the radio. It has been demonstrated maybe once before, but that was kind of a low significance detection, and people are hoping that it's going to be a very big piece of science for the SKA to do, so we need to develop the, as I said, the necessary techniques and skills and expertise and things.
And obviously you're interested in cosmology, so you're doing this on very large scales. What could we work out about cosmology, say, when the SKA comes along and lets us do big weak lensing studies?
So as I said, weak lensing is a very good way of mapping where the dark matter is in the universe. And if you can map where the dark matter is in the universe, then that can actually tell you quite a lot about dark energy, which obviously, as Joe came and spoke to you about the Dark Energy Survey, even though he was mapping dark matter, what we can do is we can see how the structures which exist in dark matter have changed and grown over time. And many things to do with cosmology will affect exactly how that process of dark matter structures growing will happen. So as gravity pulls these dark matter structures together to form ever larger and larger halos and filaments and voids, the expansion of the universe and dark energy, which causes the rate of expansion of the universe to change, essentially fights against that. So if we can see a history of how quickly and in what kind of shapes the dark matter structures have formed, then that can give us a very good handle on the nature of dark energy.
Oh, very interesting. Well, I thought I'd just ask you one more thing, which was about what you actually worked on just before you came to the University of Manchester. And it sounds as though it was in some ways related because you were also then interested in the cosmological history of the universe. And what you were looking at, as I understood, was the sizes of clusters of galaxies and trying to work out, again, does that fit in with how we think that the universe is expanding and the rate at which it's going and how it sort of formed?
Yes, so before I came to Manchester when I was in Cardiff working on my PhD, that was about clusters of galaxies and, in particular, how large the largest one should be, how massive the most massive galaxy clusters in the universe should be. Because it turns out that a lot of the theories which extend on our vanilla model of cosmology affect how these very large structures form in the universe. Galaxy clusters are the largest gravitationally bound structures in the universe. And it turns out that a lot of the sensible modifications that people can think of to our vanilla model of cosmology. One of their principal effects is to change the absolute numbers of these very, very large clusters. So it turns out that if you want to look for slightly unusual things in cosmology, these exceptionally massive clusters are a very good place to look, be that whether you're looking for interesting models of dark energy or potentially modifications to gravity, or if you're interested in the period of inflation in the very, very early universe. There are certain things to do with the statistics of the dark matter structures which are left behind by inflation, which change what we would expect the mass of the most massive cluster in the universe to be. So I took a type of statistics called extreme value statistics, which has been very popular historically in places like finance and hydrology, people predicting floods and things such as this. And I took that and applied it to the field of cosmology and worrying about these very large galaxy clusters.
So you're literally looking at the most extreme members of a group of objects, in this case galaxy clusters. You're looking at the very tail end, the most massive ones, and trying to find out whether they ought to exist based on your theory.
Yes. So from our standard model of cosmology, we can predict very well that as you go to higher and higher masses, the number of galaxy clusters which we should expect to be able to observe with those masses drops off very, very quickly. But as I say, some of the alternative extensions to cosmology change to quite a large degree just how quickly that drop-off happens. So these very rare, very unusual galaxy clusters are a very good place to look for these modifications.
And did they pose any serious threat to the current cosmological model?
Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your perspective, no, they didn't. They are fairly consistent with the standard model of cosmology.
Oh, well, it's good to know anyway,
yeah. One
way or the other.
Yeah.
I can see there's a lot of subtle statistics involved in many of these things, so we wish you luck with the future of radio weak lensing.
Thank you.